This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation about the week's news on WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Here, as always, joining us is Colin McEnroe. He is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us today, Christine Stewart. She's editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello there, Christine.
Good morning.
And Kevin Rennie. He's an attorney. He's a Hartford Current columnist, and he blogs at DailyRuckshins.com. Hello there, Kevin.
Good morning.
We are on Facebook Live today, so hello to everyone watching on Facebook Live. Also, not seen on camera, a whole group of students from the Journalism and Media Academy in Hartford are here watching today's program, so we're happy to have them here. It's kind of hard to stay focused on the governor's race in Connecticut with all the craziness in Washington. Ned Lamont and Bob Stefanowski just can't compete with the battle over the confirmation of U.S. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. So we're going to start with the governor's race, Colin, and maybe we'll start just sort of with the big question. I mean, can it compete? And is it just that this is such a snoozer of a race between Bob Stefanowski and Ned Lamont? Or is it about that there's so much other stuff happening in the world that it's eating up all the attention and brain space?
Well, I think there are kind of two gravitational pulls that are pulling in opposite directions. One of them is that, yes, this race itself is not especially compelling. These are not, I'm sorry, great candidates. They're also kind of similar in their overall profile. Two or three, if you're going to count Oz Griebel, fairly wealthy white males, business backgrounds, no government service. And there's the additional problem that the problems they talk about seem pretty intractable. It's not as though you can look at one or the other of these guys and go, oh, yeah, he's got the answer. So you sort of got that. There's a way in which this is not a naturally engaging race. Now, in the other direction, there is a kind of national sense of urgency that I assume is permeating Connecticut. There's sort of a sense that elections matter, that there's a lot on the line. So when you have something that's an attention eater like the Kavanaugh hearings, yes, in a way they pull your attention away from a not very interesting governor's race. But in another way, they may drive people to the polls, ultimately, people deciding that they need to express how strongly they feel in one direction or another. And I think for that reason, it's going to make turnout a very difficult thing to predict this time. There's a great argument for a very light turnout, in a midterm where it doesn't really feel like there's much to be gained one way or another. And then there's a great argument for heavy turnout because people are all jacked up.
What do we think about that, Christine? The idea of turnout mattering and maybe people not getting enthusiastic about either of these governor's candidates, but this very important race maybe be decided by people coming out because they're energized by something else.
Yeah, no, I think it's possible. And it's who is going to come out to vote, I think, is what is going to be really difficult to predict. Are millennials going to turn up at the polling places this year? For the first time, they outnumber the baby boomer generation. And the baby boomers have, decided elections for many, many years. And, maybe it's time that the millennials are actually going to step up this time and turn out, which has shown in the last midterm election in 2014. They did not turn out. It was the lowest turnout for that age group that we've ever seen.
Yeah, we've seen this for a while, Kevin. We don't exactly bet on millennials or whatever the millennial equivalent is turning out at the polls, but we do expect that older, more experienced voters are going to turn out. I mean, what do you think turnout means to this governor's race?
Turnout in Connecticut, if it's low, always helps the Republicans because there are fewer of them, and that means statistically that fewer Democrats. The Democrats are not turning out to their advantage. So that's helpful to Republicans. I do think that though people are engaged more than usual in the fate of Connecticut, I don't think they've concluded that any of the candidates are likely to affect it very much. I think there's the sense of Connecticut being on a wrong track is not being altered by this campaign.
That sense of Connecticut being on the wrong track, it has to do with our massive budget deficit. It has to do with what exactly? I think that's one of the things that I have a hard time getting my brain around.
People talk economic growth.
Is that what it is? Is slow economic growth a feeling like you can't
leaving,
do better? Yeah.
It's just, we haven't created many jobs, and that people feel that in their day-to-day lives.
And so we have two candidates, Colin, who are talking about, in Ned Lamont and Bob Stefanowski, different ways in which they're going to lower your taxes. Ned Lamont's going to lower your property taxes. Bob Stefanowski is going to lower your income taxes. But with the state, you know, billions of dollars in the hole, it seems unlikely that the next governor, whoever that is going to get away without raising some sort of taxes. So that's the argument that they're both making. I don't know that it's an argument they'll be able to hold true to.
Yeah, it depends on how closely people listen, how closely people reason about all this. I mean, and we should say that Ned Lamont has recently added one new element to his message, which is that he is now talking more openly about bringing the state employees unions to the table, asking them to be part of his solution to the fiscal crisis. I don't think he had said that before. Christine may correct me on that. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, you just sort of wonder. I mean, we're sitting around this table. We follow this stuff for a living. You kind of wonder what a lower information voter thinks about all this. I mean, I think to anybody who looks at this thing with open eyes, the notion of eliminating or phasing out the state income tax seems like an unrealizable dream. But I don't know. I think people absorb information kind of emotionally, and I think they absorb it kind of bluntly. Voting isn't always as rational as we want to think it is. So in some ways, it's more a question sometimes of just in terms of sort of the most crude, blunt form of message, which one of those lodges in the mind of an unaffiliated voter. And by the way, I mean, I think Kevin's absolutely right that low turnout. I mean, Bob Stefanowski cannot win this race without quite a few unaffiliated voters. And low turnout would tend to sort of help that equation in all the ways that Kevin talked about. I think Lamont has another problem. Maybe we're going to get to it, which is that he would most times the Democrat really kind of needs the cities. And if the cities don't turn out, then you've got to go fishing in that unaffiliated pond.
Well, then we should talk about Barack Obama coming out this week saying, I endorse Ned Lamont. Pictures of Ned Lamont next to Barack Obama. There's the turnout king. I mean, Barack Obama does turn out the cities. Christine, does this help?
He does turn out the cities. I don't think that it really amounts to much but a hill of beans. I mean, I don't think anybody cares who endorses any candidate when voters walk into their polling places. They don't think, oh, well, Barack Obama supported him, so I like Barack Obama, so I'm definitely going to vote for this person. I don't think it's as simple as that. The line isn't as that's why we really don't report on endorsements just in general, because I don't think that they amount to very much.
But this isn't any endorsement.
No, it's not. I think it helps turnout. I think that there will be people who might otherwise not have voted, and it's a prompt to them, too. There's Barack Obama saying, "Got to vote, to vote for Ned Lamont." It means they may vote, whereas they might otherwise not have.
It's also not as though
there's a tremendous amount of affection for Barack Obama that has only grown in the last 2 years.
And I will say, it's not as though Barack Obama, though, came out with a list of five Democrats around the country that he's supporting, and those are the only ones he's going to throw his weight behind. The list came out. It was kind of long.
It was 260. The Democrats lower down. So he endorsed 16 Democrats in the state, Ned Lamont, and then 16 other candidates who are running for state office. Those 16 candidates running for state office are being supported by the Democratic legislative leadership committee. And, they're in races that are close races where Democrats want to pick up the seats from Republicans.
But does it? Yeah. When there's 260, it's kind of like saying, Kevin, I was in the who's who of American high school students.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
OK, that
is.
Doesn't really matter all that much.
But then Ned Lamont one matters because they have the resources to amplify it.
Yeah. Colin?
I mean, to Christine's point. So if you want to know which races the Democrats think are in play,
yes.
Just run your thumb down that list. I mean, Barack Obama did not endorse William Tong. He didn't endorse Sean Wooden, Denise Merrill.
Apparently,
Kevin
those
Limbo.
Are coming.
Oh, they,
apparently,
are they coming?
He's doing these endorsements in phases and batches.
Yeah. So the other thing about this, though, I do have to say, I once again, I think for the low motivation, lower information voter, a paper endorsement by Barack Obama is probably not going to mean that much. If he comes to the state, if he has rallies in some of these cities where you can really start identifying voters and maybe having staff there to make personal contact with voters and stuff like that. That probably, that potentially could make a difference. But I don't think the kind of lazy voter right now is going to just look at that and go, oh, yeah, he says I better vote. I guess I'll do that.
Well, I think Colin can expect a phone call on November 6th.
I'm hoping. It worked out great last time.
For those following at home, Colin actually got a call from Barack Obama during his program when he was trying to make that particular point. Well, Kevin, I mean, I think you talked about Lamont able to amplify this message then. He's using some of his own money once again to amplify the message, dropping $5 million more into his campaign.
Reported on Daily Ructions, where Connecticut's news begins.
Yeah. nice plug. Tell us more about that. I mean, what do we learn from Ned Lamont, self-funding candidate, dropping $5 million more in?
He's done it before. In 2006, he spent even more against Joe Lieberman. Then he spent more against Dan Malloy in 2010 in a primary campaign. And I think this time he's still spending a lot, but it's not as much. And he's hoping to win this one for a little less money than he lost the other two.
So he said that the reason that he's dropping more money in is in order to fight against the outside money that's coming in to support Bob Stefanowski. So there's a lot of outside money. The DGA hasn't been as active, the Democratic Governors Association, in helping out Lamont. But the Republican Governors Association has been very enthusiastic in its support for Bob Stefanowski and is running TV ads that are pretty effective.
And Bob Stefanowski has not been able to raise very much money on his own from Republican donors.
Well, and I wanted to ask
and
about
he
that.
Donate, he put $2 million of his own money into his primary campaign, which turned out to be a very smart move from someone who seems like a dope. He did tell a high dollar fund small
ready, folks.
fundraising lunch the other day that that $2 million was a pretty big chunk of his net worth, so that it doesn't seem like he's going to be spending much more of his own money.
Well, I want to ask about a couple of things. One is, you know, a big chunk of his net worth. Our friend Ken Dixon reported a little bit on what these guys are actually worth. I think another thing, though, to ask is, Kevin, are the Republican Governors Association, are they throwing money into this because they are throwing money behind Bob Stefanowski, the candidate, who, as you say, hasn't really been able to raise the money that he probably could or should, or are they throwing money into we have to take back the seat.
We got to tip one.
I mean,
across the nation.
There doesn't seem to be a huge amount of enthusiasm, I guess I'm saying, for Stefanowski, the candidate.
Well, he only got 30% of the vote in the Republican primary, so that's you start out without a lot of enthusiasm, and so you have to unite the party, which he appears not to have spent much energy trying to do, and the RGA has very few pickup opportunities across the nation. In fact, they're playing defense almost everywhere. So this is a chance here, and maybe Rhode Island, they see opportunity, and they'd like to have a couple of wins on the board instead of losing so many.
I want to go back to the raising money thing, because I've been thinking a little bit about this lately, and one of the things that's remarkable about this race, I don't know what Christine and Kevin would say, but I have a hard time picturing in previous election cycles a candidate, a major party candidate, who really has... He's been living in England for years. One reason he's having a hard time raising money is because he hasn't been around for anybody's birthday party or anything like that. He's been living in London.
He didn't vote for 16 years.
Yeah. Yeah. He's been living in London for a really long time. He's also, I mean, raising campaign money, there's sort of an art to it, and everybody does it a little bit differently. You want to raise money, you want to make these phone calls in a way that makes the other person feel kind of good as opposed to terrified, which is often how people describe their fundraising phone calls from Susan Bicewitz, at least in the past. But there's a way of shaking the tree, you know, and it's not something that you just pick up on Tuesday and you're really good at it on Wednesday. It takes a while. It takes a while to kind of learn how to do that. And he's got no learning curve, no experience, and he hasn't even been around at all. So he doesn't have the kinds of intimate personal connections that can also lead you towards potential sources of campaign money. So he's sort of in a weird position. I haven't really seen a gubernatorial candidacy quite like this.
So at the Prescott-Bush dinner, when Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts got up to speak, he was like, he was speaking about, you know, Bob's business background and, you know, you guys know Bob. And the Republicans in the audience were kind of like, no, we really don't have any idea who this guy is.
And he also ran in his primary campaign as someone who was dismissive of the party organization, the party structure. So there's no rush to raise money for him or to contribute to him because his calling card has been as an outsider.
Well, and he kind of painted himself as somebody who would be able to be a self-funder.
Well, he did.
And that was not exactly truthful.
Well, and that's before we take a break. The last thing then is back to this Ken Dixon article. You look at the money. We've talked about this a bit, Colin. You know, when we were comparing Bob Stefanowski and David Stemmerman, who was running against him, the hedge fund guy, that's big money. And Bob Stefanowski had much smaller money. But if you look at Ned Lamont money versus Bob Stefanowski money, Ned Lamont has real money to put into his campaign, as Kevin said. And he has before. Bob Stefanowski maybe is a bit up against it.
Right. And whenever we talk about this stuff, I realize that we have no real capacity for wrapping our minds around these questions of like what $5 million means to a Ned Lamont or David Stemmerman. I can never quite believe that $5 million doesn't mean anything. You know, no matter how much money you've got, it just feels like an awful lot of money, $5 million, $10 million, whatever. Yes, Ned Lamont can do certain things that Bob Stefanowski cannot do. Bob Stefanowski is a very, very highly compensated CEO. He's sort of a guy, you know, who's made a lot of money by having jobs at companies, high-placed jobs at companies. With Ned Lamont, and I think we dealt with this in a previous episode, he's got like four different sources of wealth. And we're not talking about money. We're talking about wealth, which is a very different thing.
I want to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Bob Stefanowski and maybe a new appeal to women, Republicans across America, maybe not doing so well with women right now for a variety of reasons that we'll get into later in the program. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Kevin Rennie, Hartford Current columnist, blogs at dailyructions.com, also Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us is Kevin Rennie. He's an attorney. He's a Hartford Current columnist, and he also blogs at dailyructions.com. Christine Stewart is here. She's editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. Two things, Christine, quickly. You've got a voter guide up on your site. Tell us more about that.
I do. So if nobody has any information about who is running for state rep, who is running for state senator, attorney general, they can go to vote.ctnewsjunkie.com. And we've given the candidates some questionnaires and asked them to answer some questions. So hopefully you get to know your candidates a little better before you go vote for them.
Very cool. It's vote.ctnewsjunkie.com. Colin McEnroe, of course, is here. He's also host of The Colin McEnroe Show. What's on your show today, Colin?
Well, the main thing that I want to mention is that tonight at Watkinson School, I'm doing one of the forums that I do there. It's about the question of whether it's possible to have civil conversations in America about important public issues. That would seem to be the case. I've got this terrific panel. I'm really excited about them. And they've been communicating with each other via email over the last few days. And I feel like they are going to be pretty exciting. I think there's still tickets available. You can go to watkinson.org and see it. I'm pretty sure that there are, though. And so today, just so I get a break between this and that, and because the Eagles are coming to town on Saturday, we're going to rerun a show that we did about why people are so divided about the Eagles. People either really like the Eagles or really hate the Eagles. The show starts with a guy who almost got into a fistfight in a bar because somebody overheard him saying negative stuff about
Yale?
The Eagles.
Is
no, it was not. Well,
at Demery?
It wasn't far from Yale, actually.
Okay, so.
Was it a Deke?
Yeah. The Eagles this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. Really interesting conversation at Watkinson School. And actually, interesting conversation for you, Christine. You're moderating a gubernatorial forum tonight. What's the subject of this?
I am. So the subject of this is going to be young children and working families. Go figure. So Ned Lamont and Oz Griebel are going to be answering some tough questions tonight.
But there's another candidate.
Yeah, there is another candidate. He is has declined to attend.
Let's actually play a little bit from the last debate. We had Bob Stefanowski, probably isn't coming, as Christine said, to this forum. But in a most recent debate hosted by WFSB, there is a bit of a lightning round, some questions at the end. Here's the candidates and the question that was put to them.
Should Brett Kavanaugh be approved for the Supreme Court?
Mr. Stefanowski.
I'm going to pass on that. That's a federal issue.
Mr. Lamont.
I don't think he should be approved. And by the way, governors appoint Supreme Court justices here in the state. And you want to know where we stand on these issues. You want to know where we stand.
Mr. Griebel.
I think the women who've come forward have to be heard. I also think Judge Kavanaugh deserves a fair hearing.
In that, Kevin, probably nothing surprising out of the mouth of Oz Griebel, nothing surprising out of the mouth of Ned Lamont. Were you surprised by Bob Stefanowski's reaction?
I was not surprised. No, he doesn't like to answer questions, even questions that he should have anticipated. He just doesn't like to answer questions.
Even if you don't have a great answer for the question, you try to kind of answer that question right now in America.
Well, I would think that, a question that is dominating American discourse, you would have some thought, not just that you would answer it, but that you'd have some thoughts of your own that you might want to share with people of Connecticut or around your dinner table.
Part of that is strategy, I think, and then part of that is he's new to politics and he just doesn't know.
What's the to tell us about the strategy as you can divine it? Like, what do you make of the strategy?
The less
there?
You say about any subject matter, the greater the ability you have to find voters who will support you, because they don't have any specific knowledge about certain issues.
But it speaks perhaps, Colin, to that second thing that Christine said, which is as a less polished politician, we both known lots of politicians over the years who can say absolutely nothing but by actually saying something. I don't know that I want to weigh in on that right now. Of course, this is before the FBI. There's a lot to be heard so far. It seems as though not answering the question probably is not the right way to handle that.
Well, yeah, it does sort of depend. And I think it would be maybe wrong of us to paint the picture of Stefanowski as a guy who can't win because he's so inexperienced and doesn't know what he's doing, although it's possible to paint picture. But I think he still can win this election.
Oh,
and one way that he's going to – if he's going to win this election, he's going to win it with unaffiliated voters. You can't, as a Republican, because of the numbers in Connecticut, you cannot win without large numbers of unaffiliated voters. And he may not know exactly what to say about an issue like that one that would satisfy – he knows what to say to make Republicans happy. He doesn't know what to say to make unaffiliated voters happy. That would be the reason for not doing it. But I do want to say one quick thing about this. If we went and asked 10 campaign professionals, the people who get paid to run campaigns, what the most important attributes of a candidate are, they might start with something like, just a general, like a Johanna Hayes kind of charisma. You can't make that up. It's people either have it or they don't. But very quickly after things like that would be just fire in the belly, the willingness to work around the clock, wanting it so bad that you will do whatever you have to do to be prepared, to be ready, to raise the money. And there's a sense with Stefanowski that he's a horse that doesn't really want to run around the track very often. He doesn't want to run very fast. He doesn't want to work very hard. And that ultimately could cost him. I mean, if he's not willing to get ready for a debate, for example, and have answers to questions, that actually could hurt him.
He doesn't have time to do that because he's fundraising. So he doesn't have time to get to understand some of the issues in the state of Connecticut because he has to go out and raise the money because he doesn't have
it. He's had over a year. I can tell you a year ago, he was shockingly ignorant of just basic issues in Connecticut. That's something you can fix. But, I the clip you played was last Wednesday night. Mm-hmm. Thursday was the hearing.
That's right. Fair enough.
He could have said, like millions of other Americans, I'm going to be paying attention to what happens at tomorrow's Judiciary Committee.
I'll make up my mind after I hear that. And
like every fair-minded American,
as anybody else, right? We don't know the whole story, and hopefully we'll find out more. To get back to that, Christine, you've written about Stefanowski's supporters actually starting a group to try to get a coalition of women to support the candidate, in large part because not just Bob Stefanowski, but certainly Republican candidates around the nation are showing this softness with women voters, just in large part because of Donald Trump, Brett Kavanaugh, and a lot of the other stuff that we've seen over the course of the last couple months.
Yeah, there is no surprise another gender gap here in the race for the governor. So the Quinnipiac University poll and the Sacred Heart poll both found that Bob Stefanowski, the support among women is there's definitely a gap that 50% of in the Sacred Heart poll, 50% of female voters supported Lamont over Stefanowski, compared to the 28% who supported Stefanowski. So, you know, the same with the Quinnipiac. I think that they run the risk of losing female voters. And if you lose female voters, I think we saw Linda McMahon in 2010 and 2012, even though she tried to make a go at female voters between 2010 and 2012, was unable to make up that difference.
Just could never. Just could never boost her numbers among.
So what does the attempt look like? I mean, what do Stefanowski supporters do to try to capture more of that?
So I guess they're going to be, you know, they have a Facebook group. They're going to be, you know, going around the state, the women who do support him, and having having meetings and networking.
That sounds like a small move toward
that, toward, you know, and it's really late in the game, guys. It's, you know, like, well, you know, we're almost like less than 30 days out from the election.
It's late, but he's a blank slate. So they can, you know, they can sort of portray him as they think is most to their advantage.
We have a little less than a minute, Colin. Quick thought.
The nightmare, I think, is that you have a lot of women voters who are motivated by the Kavanaugh hearings who come out. That turns out to be a big turnout factor in November. They get into the voting booth, and they have no reason not to vote state Democratic. So, I mean, if you're Stefanowski, that's what you're worried about, right? That more women than usual come out to vote, and they are ginned up by the Kavanaugh stuff, and the only thing that they're going to do is vote for the Democrat if they don't know anything else about the candidates.
We're hearing from Colin McEnroe, from Kevin Rennie, from Christine Stort, and I'm John Dankosky, the host of The Wheelhouse. And we're going to go to some friends right now who are going to tell you why and how you can support WNPR. All of this news, this analysis, the information that you get on a daily basis comes to you because of listener support. So do your part right now. Here's some friends to tell you how. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Kevin Rennie's here. He's a blogger at DailyRuctions.com, a columnist at The Hartford Current, and Christine Stort, the editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. We're going to turn to Washington in just a moment, but we ran out of time, and we didn't get a chance to talk, Christine, about one of the most important figures in this governor's race, the outgoing governor, Dan Malloy. Bob Stefanowski has spent most of his time calling Ned Lamont Ned Malloy, which I'm not quite sure how effective that is, but he's trying to link the policies of Dan Malloy to what Ned Lamont might do. He's been talking about how Dan Malloy authored two of the top tax hikes in Connecticut history. Our friend Keith Faniff of the Connecticut Mirror somewhat debunked that in a large piece earlier this week. And also, there was some news this week that I found kind of interesting. You know, as General Electric, after its move to Boston, ousts yet another CEO, their stock prices tumble. They've been delisted from the Dow Jones. It seems as though one of the big quote-unquote failures of the Malloy governorship, losing GE, isn't necessarily turning out so bad for the state. I guess I'm wondering if all of the doom about Governor Malloy's tenure here is something that Bob Stefanowski really can capitalize on.
Yeah, I'm not sure what Dan Malloy's legacy is going to be. You know, it should be interesting. I think that there's universal. He's expended all of the political capital that he has.
A while ago,
he expended all the political capital he had. He may have done it before his reelection campaign in 2014. Yeah. But since that time, he's just I don't think that people are going to. I think people in Connecticut, I think voters are smart in that they're going to be able to separate their feelings about Dan Malloy from their feelings about who they're going to vote for governor and the state of the state. And I think that Dan Malloy's legacy will be a little bit nicer to him in a few years when somebody else gets in there and figures out how messed up things really were.
Kevin, what do you think about that? I mean, what do you think the Dan Malloy legacy looks like, and how powerful is it for Bob Stefanowski to be basically running every day against Dan Malloy as opposed to against Ned Lamont?
It's a powerful tool. Malloy's approval rating is at about 16%, which is just astonishing. The intensity of dislike for him can be jarring to witness. And he's leaving a $4.6 billion deficit, which is, in the short term, that's certainly his immediate legacy. And for someone
But let's see, you know, he didn't have anything to do with this budget. It was the bipartisan budget.
But that created that deficit.
He did sign it.
Well, and he's the leader of the state of Connecticut, and he has been for 8 years. Yeah. And he got reelected claiming that he had fixed Connecticut's finances. And a month after he was reelected, his closest aides very big raises, they declared we're in a permanent financial crisis. And then there was a very significant deficit announced right after that. He got reelected by not telling the truth. And the danger we face now, particularly with Bob Stefanowski, is if we have another governor who gets elected by not telling the truth, you're never going to be able to unite important elements of our state to fix these problems.
I think history will be kinder, probably a lot kinder to Dan Malloy than we are right now. I mean, a lot of that has to do with the fact that people will forget his personality. They'll forget the whole porcupine thing, and they'll look at things like criminal justice reform, legalization of, or at least decriminalization of marijuana, medical marijuana, abolishing the death penalty. There's a long string of things that don't exist in the fiscal sphere. Ultimately, whether somebody else could have done a better job of addressing the problems that he did inherit is a debatable question. But there's also, I mean, this is too long a conversation, but like who is the best governor? I sort of think Ella Grasso was the best governor of my lifetime, but it's, you know, and Lowell Weicker will be known for that one thing. But, you know, history looking at governors is always kind of an interesting question. I mean, how do you even decide who was a good governor?
I want to turn to Washington right now because we started the program saying it's kind of hard to pay attention to this governor's race with so much on a daily basis coming out of Washington. And, you know, there are things even within the last 24 hours that Donald Trump has said that we won't even have time to, that a lot of the national news media is paying attention to. One thing that does hit home here is it's been evident for quite a while that President Trump just does not like U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Now, the feeling's probably mutual. Trump, though, keeps signaling out Blumenthal for some of his sharpest scorn. He did it again this week. Take a listen.
Look at Blumenthal. He lied about Vietnam. He didn't just say, hey, I went to Vietnam. No, no. For 15 years, he said he was a war hero. He fought in Da Nang province. We call him Da Nang Richard. Da Nang. That's his nickname. Da Nang. He never went to Vietnam. And he's up there saying, we need honesty and we need integrity.
So, in large part, this is coming not just because Richard Blumenthal and Donald Trump have not gotten along for quite some time, Colin, but because Blumenthal has led some of the sharpest criticism of Brett Kavanaugh, amongst other things right now. Quite a bit of what Donald Trump is saying is personal. Quite a bit of what he's saying is just wrong.
Right. Well, if we want to start there, I mean, go back to the beginning of that quote where he says he didn't just say he went to Vietnam. No, that is what he did. I mean, on the occasions where you could say Dick Blumenthal lied, the way that he lied was by suggesting that he was in Vietnam, not that he was in battles, not that he was in Da Nang, not that he was a hero who fought bravely. He never said any of those things. There were occasions where he made it seem like he was actually in the country of Vietnam as opposed to in Washington, D.C., but in the service during that time. And a lot of this actually comes, I think, from the original New York Times story about this was somewhat badly reported and heavily orchestrated by Ed Petru, who was at that time Linda McMahon's. I guess he was the
communications director.
It was written by Ray Hernandez,
who went to work for Ed Petru.
And the article itself stands up, and so does the follow-up article where even more quotes came out.
I think
we have to face this. Dick Blumenthal made these nutty claims. Some of them were reported. What are the odds that every time he said it, there was a reporter standing by to take down his words? Probably not very likely.
Right, but lying someone, about his
no,
false
no,
claims.
Oh,
is,
Donald, yeah. Donald Trump is a lunatic, and what he says in these press conferences, you know, most of it you can't believe. Part of it may be, you know, he's very friendly with Vince McMahon, and I'm sure at the time he was probably hearing tales of it, and it's all gotten distorted, except for the underlying fact, which is Blumenthal kept saying these crazy things about having when we came back from Vietnam. And it just it is there's never been a satisfactory explanation for it.
It meant that during the Kavanaugh things, him invoking the falsus in unibus,
yes.
falsus in omnibus principle was probably a tactical mistake. They should have given that to somebody else to do. Before you go to Christine, I just want to say we do need to talk about the emoluments lawsuit because that's, I think, what's driving Trump right now.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, quickly, Christine.
No, go. Yeah. I was just going to say, you know, it doesn't matter what anybody says or what anybody reports. There is a certain segment of the population right now that doesn't believe anything that they're receiving, except if it's coming from Donald Trump. So,
And so let's get.
But
to
you
this.
Think he's yeah. he's their sole truth teller?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely.
The Connecticut Mirror's Anna Radelet reports a federal judge on Friday gave the go-ahead to a lawsuit led by Senator Richard Blumenthal and joined by dozens of congressional Democrats who claim President Donald Trump has violated the U.S. Constitution by failing to seek and obtain the consent of Congress before accepting benefits from foreign states. It's called Blumenthal versus Trump, based on the Constitution's emoluments clause. So, Colin, this is at the heart of it, but it's also of a piece with what happened during the Kavanaugh hearings. I don't think it's just about this.
No, probably not just about this, but the way that it touches. I mean, Donald Trump, look, if Donald Trump has to cut Brett Kavanaugh loose tomorrow, by Sunday, he won't remember Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, Brett Kavanaugh isn't like this person in whom Donald Trump has an enormous personal investment. The person in whom Donald Trump has an enormous personal investment is Donald Trump. And this emoluments lawsuit goes right at the heart of who he is and what's important to him. He has, in a way that is just mind-boggling, used his presidency as a way to make private money. I think that's a fair and a basically unassailable statement. And you know, whether or not the letter of the law ultimately decides that this is a valid emoluments case, which it certainly looks like, there's just no question that the framers of the Constitution did not want presidents using the office of the presidency to make money.
Yeah, this lawsuit, so this happened on Friday after the Kavanaugh hearings. This decision came down from the court, and so it gives Blumenthal and Congress standing to be able to ask for these financial business dealings of President Trump.
And since we have a clearly
what he guards.
Yeah.
More closely than anything else in his life.
What do you think about this case? What do you think about this emoluments argument, the receiving gifts from foreign governments and running a business as he has while also running the country?
Yeah, I think we have a right to know if that's and you know this is not a very legal answer. This is a political answer, but if that's a legitimate route to finding out, and frankly, it seems to me that he has not taken his hand off the tiller on his businesses, that this may be a way to find out because, you know, he not revealing his income taxes has been sort of one of his top goals, which should be a reminder as to why haven't we seen Ned Lamont's and Bob Stefanowski's income tax returns?
Let's just pause here and ask that question. We have not seen those yet, have we, Christine?
We have not. We've seen Oz Grable's tax returns.
Yeah.
We have, you know, Ned Lamont is trying to use he says he's happy to release his tax returns, 3 years of his tax returns. He's trying to use that as leverage to get Bob Stefanowski to also release his tax returns. So I don't know.
I think releasing them would be that leverage?
Mm-hmm.
Typically, when they don't want to release their tax returns, it's because they are rich and they are paying an effective tax rate of zero. I mean, that's typical or close to it.
Right.
That's usually
like Tom Foley.
Yeah, I mean, did you one of the reporters? Did you have to like be driven in a hooded, you know, van to a secret location.
Yes, to a secret location,
to look at Tom Foley's tax returns.
Yes,
But I mean, yeah, that's usually the thing that they don't want to tell anybody, you know, is that they pay a much lower – it's the Warren Buffett thing. You know, they pay a lower tax rate than
Foley
one of the
didn't
sectors.
Pay any taxes, right? Yeah.
Right.
$365,
I think.
Yeah, it was something ridiculous
and,
like that.
And the – in 2006, we went to a odd location, I think in Meriden for – at a hotel in a room with an accountant for Ned Lamont. And you couldn't make any copies or
they take your pens away and they hold your hands. And they
and this, of course, this whole question of tax returns is at the heart of this gigantic, almost too large to consume report that came out from The New York Times within the last day about Trump, his family, and the ways in which they were able to dodge paying taxes over the course of many decades, Colin, not just speaking to whether or not Donald Trump pays taxes like every other American, which clearly he doesn't, but also getting at the very heart of the story Donald Trump has been telling for quite some time, that he got a $1 million loan from his dad and that's all the help he ever got.
Right. Now one of the reasons you want to see his tax return is if, in fact, he got $413 million or whatever it is from his father, plus a lot of other stuff like these low interest or almost non-existent loans and stuff like that. It would be interesting to know what his net worth is right now, adjusted for time. Like, if he's worth less than $413 million, he's a really bad businessman. I mean, if he's never been able to really build on any of that, if his true worth is less than that, that would be quite an indictment, quite a reduction in his overall story.
I guess I'm just, well, a quick comment on that, Kevin. I mean, this is a part of the foundation story, and Christina said it before. I mean, we have millions and millions of Americans who look to Donald Trump as the only arbiter of the truth. He tells it straight. The mainstream news media, the failing New York Times, does not. Does it matter if it becomes clear that Donald Trump isn't saying anything true about his taxes?
It may matter on the edges. I think his more contemporary tax returns would tell us a great deal more than this. But their response has been just that it's misleading. And I there was not a full-throated repudiation of the report, which I thought was interesting.
Quick thought, Christine?
No, I just think it's going to be the next few months are going to be pretty interesting.
The next few months are going to be very interesting. And I know one thing is true. We're not going to get Donald Trump's tax returns within the next couple months. Christine Sorr from CTNewsJunkie.com. Check out that voter guide on the site. Thanks so much, Christine.
Thanks, John.
Thanks to Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Courant, from Daily Ructions. Thank you, Kevin.
You're welcome.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show.
Thank you, sir.
The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Breedy. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Kion Wolf is the technical producer. Panina Breedy. Beedy helped out with the show today. Carlos Mejia is the one who put us on Facebook Live. And I'm going to turn it over to some colleagues right now who are going to tell you why and how you can support WNPR and all the things you hear right here on Connecticut Public Radio.
Once again, you've been listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lydia Brown here with Harriet Jones, asking you for your pledge of support during our October fundraising campaign. This is one of just a handful of drives that we hold each year to ensure that we can continue to bring you the programs that you have come to love and rely on this station, whether it's national programs like Morning Edition and All Things Considered, to the local news and talk shows that you hear, programs like The Wheelhouse, Where We Live, The Colin McEnroe Show, The Faith Middleton Food Schmooze next. We have 12 hours of locally produced talk shows here on this station. It's something that we are very proud of, and we hope you are as well and will consider supporting it today. It's quick, it's easy, it's secure. All you have to do is go to the phone, 1-800-584-2788, or visit us online at WNPR.org.
We've had some people step up already. Thank you so much for your pledge of support. Caroline in New Haven says, what would we do without the news or other fantastic programming on WNPR? Caroline, I don't know, and I hope you never find out. Thank you so much for stepping forward and becoming part of our, you know, our process here. You know, it really all starts with you, and it's for you too. This is a circle. You give the money, we make the content, and you appreciate that content. And, you know, that's the way that it should work. Greg in Collinsville says, listening to NPR gives me the comfort that I live in a potentially civilized world. It does feel a little bit like that these days, doesn't it? You're clinging on to any source of support that you can. But Greg, thank you so much. I'm so glad that we are there for you and that that means so much to you. Step forward, won't you, and you know, also give your pledge of support. Join these wonderful people that have pledged to us this morning. 1-800-584-2788. 1-800-584-2788. A wonderful incentive we have for you. This drive is for any political junkies out there. We have a mm-hmm. chance for you to meet Doris Kearns Goodwin,
so cool.
who is just a legend. Mm-hmm. She's actually going to be in New Haven on November 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Lyman Center in New Haven. She's going to be talking about her new book, Leadership in Turbulent Times. We have 8 pairs of VIP tickets. That means you not only get to see the talk, you actually get to meet her, have a meet and greet with Doris Kearns Goodwin. What do you have to do to get this amazing benefit? You have to call 1-800-584-2788 and pledge in any amount. You will be entered into a drawing for these tickets. So as if you know, just the wonderful programming wasn't enough, you can also get a chance to meet Doris Kearns Goodwin. 1-800-584-2788.
Or go online to WNPR.org. And as we've been talking about this morning, when you go to WNPR.org and click on that red donate button, you'll be able to check out all of the great gift items that we have there to say thank you for your support. But once again, we couldn't do it without you. We hope the programming itself is enough. 1-800-584-2788 or WNPR.org.
This is Connecticut Public.